what I think we've lost in today's political discussion. We've so dug in the trenches on our side that we've forgotten that this stuff really does matter in terms of the government at its best is about solving problems and serving people. And it's not about winning the argument.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Life Reframed. I'm Lauren Morgan.
And I'm Rick Dunn.
Today we have got, I always say a special guest, but we have very special guest with us.
I know, and this one, Lauren, I think that we bring on just amazing guests. Sometimes people don't know who they are, and they start to listen like, my gosh, that's an amazing person. Now, this is an amazing person, but more people are going to recognize him, and so I'll get right to the introduction. Bill, we're glad to have you, first of all. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks. And Lauren's already given me the pre-warning that even though you say it's a special guest, it's really not all that special.
Listen, that's for all. We're going to have to start this whole thing over. I've already messed up.
Oh, no.
So, really, that's for all the other people.
That's right.
That's to emphasize that you're the actual real special guest.
Got it.
And welcome to Life Reframe because it's just raw as it can be.
Well,
so.
Okay. So, and we haven't even said it. We have Bill Haslam with us today.
We did.
Everybody does not know just who Bill is.
Yeah, people in the Knoxville community know Bill as a wonderful part of our community, was the regional Young Life director for a couple of years, has been our mayor, has been the governor of our state. And Bill, we just thank you for all you've done in serving in our community, in our state, and we are all the beneficiaries of that. So we begin by saying we appreciate that and look forward to our listeners getting to know you.
Every one of those roles, it literally has been an honor to do it. And all those days, I almost always was pinching myself. I can't believe I get to do this. So thanks. But I have loved every bit of it.
It's really great. Reading your book, and we'll talk a little bit more about your book. You talk about that in there. And it's neat to see that because you always wonder, what is it really like? And do people in all different roles enjoy their jobs? But it was cool to read you talk about that, how you really enjoyed what you did serving in the public.
It's cliche, but it really was an honor. I mean, every day I would walk up the steps of the Capitol and, okay, somebody's going to come get me and say, get out of here, buddy. The real governor's got to come work.
That's hilarious. So as Rick said, everybody probably knows who you are, but will you spend a couple of minutes and just tell us a little bit more about you or your family and whatever you would like people to know about you?
I grew up in Knoxville. I had a brother and sister. My mom died when I was in high school, about the time that I really first clearly heard the gospel at a Young Life camp and decided to follow Jesus from that point on. I went to college down at Atlanta at Emory University, met Chrissy there. She's from Memphis. We got married a year out of college and eventually had three children, all of whom are in their mid-30s and have had the wisdom to bless us with 10 grandchildren, which is really fun. I tell people that being a grandparent is one of the few things in life that is not overrated. It's all it's cracked up to be. And was in business here for 20 plus years with Pilot Corporation. Spent a couple of years, actually, ironically, because I don't know anything about fashion, but working for Saks Fifth Avenue, setting up their online retail business. I came back, helped out with Young Life for a period of time, and then ran for mayor of Knoxville in 2003, reelected in 2007, ran for governor in 2010, and was reelected in 2014. So that's a quick summary.
That's great. What have you been doing since you wrapped up being the governor?
Yeah, so we spent a little time just putting our lives back in order. The job is fairly demanding, so you put a lot of things on hold. So we spent a little time catching up with life and making up time with grandchildren and friends. Been back in Knoxville and still over Nashville some. Really doing a variety of things, serving on several boards, both for-profit and not-for-profit. Have some business interests I've gotten involved in. And then I wrote a book that came out 2 or 3 months ago called Faithful Presence. And Rick is a real author and can tell you a lot more about the process than I can. But writing a book it ended up for someone like me being a lot harder than it looked. And so spent a decent amount of time working on that and then helping talk about it since it's come out.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm sure all those grandkids have enjoyed having you around a little bit more, too.
They love having somebody to wrestle with and chase. And in the old days, I could outrun them, but now that's rapidly changing.
They're getting bigger, I'm sure. It probably has nothing to do with you getting older.
I can relate to that. I get that.
Well said.
Just to give everybody a heads up, we're doing a phone call with you. And so if anyone notices any sound stuff, it's 100% because Rick is not technologically savvy and it's his phone that we're using. So we just need to put that out there for everybody.
And I
kind of like this. If anything goes wrong, we just blame it on Rick. I kind of like this whole model.
Yeah. This is the podcast. This is how it works.
it's life reframed about it around it's Rick's fault. That's
it's
what it
all
is.
So,
subtitle, blame it on Rick.
Blame it on Rick. There you go.
I read your book recently. I found it very engaging, and it was just, I wanted to keep reading it. It was hard to put down. You use so many things, like there's humor in it, hearing like some of the stories of things that you've been through, and then just your overall, I think, view on everything. It's a really great read. We'll link to it in the show notes, of course, for people to be able to find it. But writing the book, you said it was a harder process than you would have thought it would be. How do you feel? Like, how did it feel getting it out there to the world?
Interesting. It's, I've never delivered a baby, but so I can't, that every time I start a sentence that way, my wife looks at me with these eyes like, don't go there. But there's that process of you that you've been anticipating, and then it finally happens. And so there's a huge kind of sense of excitement. But the one thing that's really different about this, about writing a book, is you do all the work and then you hand it to the publisher for a long time, like 7 or 8 months they have it before it comes back and it's actually a real book. And so it's like you do all this work and then it moves out of your life and everything goes quiet and then bam, it comes back. It's been fun. And for me, one of the best things has been that I totally unanticipated is it's really led me into a lot of conversations with old friends and new friends in really personal ways, particularly about the gospel and the gospel's impact on what we do in our everyday life. And I wasn't expecting that kind of treat of, oh, wow, I found myself in the middle of so many good conversations that the book was the initiator for.
I love that. So one of the things that I actually thought about as I was reading it was how relatable and current everything in it is. So even though I'm not sure when you wrote it, but obviously it spent a lot of time, like you said, with the publisher, but you could have written it this year. Like you could have sat down and wrote it earlier this year and it would have been no more appropriate and applicable for our current climate. And maybe that will always be the case, but it's just so relatable to everything that's going on right now. And I thought that was so fascinating because I know that book writing is a long process.
Thank you. I need to hire you to be the, to do the promotion for this book, by the way.
I'll have Rick send you my number later. I'm looking for another gig. Yeah. I got to get out of this podcasting one.
When you got a bad boss, you got a bad boss. Yeah.
You know, suddenly I'm rethinking the idea of having you on, Bill. I'm beginning to wonder if this was really a God-inspired thought after all.
One of the points of the book is this, is all of us who are Christians, we get a lot of instruction on theology, if you will, about how we approach things. So if you're married, you've probably been to so many seminars and Sunday schools and Bible studies about marriage and the same thing about raising kids. And if you're in business, you've read lots of books about here's what it looks like to be a Christian business person. We haven't really done the same amount of instruction around our kind of theology or how we should view our politics. And so everybody knows certain positions like here, or Christians think this about abortion or about marriage or whatever it is. But we really haven't talked about what's it look like just to be faithfully present in the public square. Set aside the issues, but what would it look like to be that person? The same way that, you know, when we have a student ministry in high school or college, it's not about teaching them how to make all A's. It's about how do you walk faithfully in your high school or your middle school or your college. I think the ways that God wants us to walk faithfully in the public square are no different today than they were 100 years ago, or they will be 100 years from now. And so I'm hoping that's what we begin to rethink is, you know, when people think about us in the public square, how should they think about us?
Yeah, and Bill, that transcendent perspective of the gospel is really clear through the book. It also, just for listeners, because I'm sure people have ideas about what you're going to say and what you're going to do because of the way our country operates right now, but it also transcends political party and political ideology. This is not a book of Bill Haslam seeking to win people over to his perspectives politically or ideologically when it relates to certain laws or bills, or This is really about all believers of all different ideological persuasions learning how to be a faithful presence together and how that could look like in contrast to some of the things we're experiencing right now.
Thanks. I really hope that. And one of the things is scripture is full of advice and admonition to us about how we're supposed to act. And it's not contingent upon our circumstances. I always say in politics today, because people feel like the stakes are so high and it's turned into such a battle that they're saying we can't unilaterally disarm because the other side is shooting for keeps.
Mm.
And all this means so much. And it does mean so much. I am not, I hope everybody hears me. This is not about whether the things that we firmly believe we should push to the side and adopt a Jell-O-like approach. But it also doesn't mean that we get to, because the stakes are so high, suspend the things that God asks of us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that in other walks of life. We don't say, listen, in business, you need to be ethical unless you're about to go out of business, and then you can bend the rules some.
That's a great observation.
Or in your marriage, you would never say, listen, I'm expecting you to be faithful unless that person in the next cubicle is really hot. In that case, we'll give you a waiver.
Wow.
But somehow we've said that in our political life. We've said, because these circumstances are so great, the ways that scripture asks us to act, we don't have to do.
So good. That is, it's so good. I want to keep talking about that and a little bit in your experience of being mayor and governor. It seems like what you have written in the book now is like what you have lived out as being a leader. I mean, how have you been changed? I'm sure that you've been through a lot to get to this point where you have this perspective. That may not be an easy question because that feels loaded. But what are some ways where you've lived through this and seen it play out through your leadership roles?
Yeah, so I'd probably say this, and I'm guessing, Rick, you feel this way. When you give a sermon and then you find yourself the next week or two thinking, dang, I hope nobody's watching me now.
Yeah, because I'm different now, right? Yeah.
I decided to do the audio recording for this book just because I thought, I don't know if I'm ever going to write another one, so I'll do it in my own voice this time just to experience that. As I was reading it aloud, I was almost convicted myself of, dang, I'm all the things that I'm saying that Christians shouldn't do, I've been either doing that or desiring to do that in my political actions just in the last few weeks. I've been the one wanting to yell at the TV or to send back the sarcastic reply on social media to folks, or all the things that I think the things we shouldn't do. There's nothing like giving a sermon or writing a book or teaching a lesson that's as self-convicting as that can be.
It becomes a powerful mirror, doesn't it?
It does. It does. So that'd be the first point. The second thing I will say this is, I think God uses lots of different things to form us. Paul talks about, he says, until Christ is formed in you. And for me, being engaged in the public square, and by the way, when I say that, I'm not just talking about people who run for office. I think all of us are called to engage in the public square in some way. But for me, that is one of the things that God has used to shape me more than anything else. And sometimes it's by seeing the ways that either I or others have reacted in the public square, that we haven't been people who are seeking the best answer instead of just our answer. And I've seen what a difference it makes when people really do approach saying, hey, my job is to seek the peace of the city that where I'm called, as Jeremiah said, and to truly want to do that versus I'm here to win the argument. And I've seen such a difference it makes in that when, at the end of the day, this gospel that we say we believe, it really is true. And it really a case of God's wisdom proving out in the people and places around us and getting to see that happen.
You've used this word humility a lot in the book, Bill. And then at one point you even said, and I told you this was like my biggest takeaway, and it so connects with what Lauren and I do on Life Reframed. You said leadership is a paraphrase. Leadership's about being vulnerable. It's vulnerability. And regardless of what roles we may be in or what situations or contexts we may be in, you said business or politics or anything, and you say, but lead we must. I get from that that there were times, and I think you say in the book, but I love for listeners to hear, there are times when you were faced with decisions that there's just no easy right, left turn. You shared about how you get criticism from both sides. Talk a little bit with us about living with Jesus in those vulnerable places.
I think that the vulnerability of any leadership role really, I think, is Christ-forming for all of us. And by the way, I think that's true of again, no matter what walk of life you have. But you quickly learn in public life, like the whole you're not going to make everybody happy really is true. And the truth is, if somebody gets elected in today's world, when they win by 10 points, that's a landslide. 55 to 45 is a landslide.
Mm-hmm.
But that still means, if you think about it, that almost every other person that you pass on the street didn't want you to win or is against you. And after a while, you learn to live with this sense of everybody's got an opinion about me. It's like a pastor. Everybody has an opinion about me. A lot of folks would choose someone else if they could. But this reality of I think this is where God has called me to be and my job is to walk faithfully. And I think that, at least for me, that the word that God kept using through the whole time for me is humility. I went back and counted in the times that either humility or pride is used in the New Testament, like 400 or 500 times.
Really?
And the clear summary is like, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble.
Yeah.
And Peter and James both use that exact same verse, and they're not quoting something in the Old Testament. And so you're thinking, Peter, maybe the closest disciple to Jesus, James, Jesus' brother, both say the exact same thing. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And I feel like it's just a really clear call that we have missed in the public square. If you if we all went down to gather downtown or wherever we want to and started asking people, how do you think of Christians in the public square? I'm afraid humility wouldn't come up for a long time.
Yeah.
Lots of other words would, but I doubt you would.
There's nothing more, I think, appealing and engaging than a leader who is full of humility. Humility and vulnerability, it just draws you in. Even if it's not somebody that you would necessarily be best friends with or
even agree with.
Yeah, even agree with. Nobody can deny the power of the humility and vulnerability.
Well, let me ask you all a question. So I'll flip the tables just for a minute. Why do you think that is? Why is it that we are so engaged by humble leaders?
So my immediate response to that is because I don't think we see it very often. I don't know if that's right or not, but it just, to me, when you see it, it's rare. It's rare to see people being vulnerable in life in general. I talk about that a lot, but I think the same is true with humble leaders. I don't know.
I know. I think you're right. First of all, it's light in the darkness right now, right? When you're describing this, I'm reading the book. I'm like, yeah, this is not what we're experiencing. And I'd say, not just in the public square, but a lot of times, and we're hearing a lot of podcasts and books right now about the lack of humility among Christian leaders and churches and other places. So I think that's right on track. I'd also add, I believe we were created to be in deep, intimate relationship with the God of the universe through his humility and vulnerability. And so I believe it's in the very image of God in us to be drawn to that because it's who he is. And so when a leader is in a place of authority and power and strength and orients themselves with humility and vulnerability, I think it taps into something in us that was designed to relate to our Father.
I think you're both right. You were both referring to it. We live in a world that's all about self-actualization. Mm-hmm. You need to live your best life. You need to be your best you, et cetera. But the gospel is all about self-sacrifice, not self-actualization. And I think there's something that when people see that, their hearts are pulled toward what really is true, the weariness that we all get from everybody wanting to be their very best self.
It is too. And you're in both those instances, you're talking about stewarding power and authority through a heart of humility and vulnerability. And that is absolutely the gospel.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, just touch on for people, the public square aspect, because you talk throughout the book, and you mentioned this, about it's not just politicians, it's not just leader of a big church or whatever, like we all have a role in the public square. And that's so true now more than ever with social media and everything that we're putting out there. And so I kind of wanted to draw that out a little bit so that people don't tune out and think, not that anyone would tune out listening to you. Let me, I'm just going to throw that out there.
But yeah, sure.
So that people aren't like, this doesn't apply to me. I'm not in the public square, because really we kind of are all doing something, whether it's like the people who see me dropping off my kid at school in the morning being like, get out of the car. They're seeing me yell.
Or,
not me. That's what someone else would do.
Totally hypothetical. Hypothetical.
Yeah. Or the stuff we post online. And I thought one of the interesting things you talked about was how the people of faith, that we should play a leading role in helping heal the wounds of the country, and how much we've not been helpful in that. And I think that's turned off. So, I mean, it's turned me off towards fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, where I'm like, what are we doing to each other? And what are we doing here? And you talk a lot about that, which I thought was so interesting, that we have this responsibility.
Yeah, people ask me all the time, because no matter where you are on the political spectrum, everybody is frustrated, right? And people ask me all the time, what, do you see any hope that we're going to get out of this? And my real answer, and the main reason I wrote the book, is this: when the world goes bad, Jesus looks at us first. When the woman's caught in adultery, he looks at the religious type. When he says, hey, when the meat goes bad, it's not the meat's fault, it's the salt. And for us as believers in this country, we should hear that with trepidation. Because as much as we wring our hands and look and say, look, the culture's going to pot and the world, look what the world's becoming, Jesus says, if the meat's gone bad, it's the salt's fault. And if the salt has lost its saltiness, it's good for nothing except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. We should all read that when we look at what's happened around us with a, uh-oh, we can't be pointing fingers. Jesus says it's about us. In my response to where we are as a country and bitterly divided and at each other's throats, is we should begin with ourselves and say, what should we, as people of the light, be bringing to this darkness?
This reminds me of a moment in the book, and I hope I get the details. You have the outgoing Governor Bredesen, and you were having a conversation. He said something along the lines, hey, there's all kinds of things you can do. Just focus on the things that you should do, or the things that you're trying to do for good. And then you said, right, that's how the church, how all of us should be, is find the thing that you can do that brings the good and focus there. Did I get that right?
You did. His words to me were really good. He said the governor should do what only the governor can do, and made the parallel to, for us, it's a question of, what does it look like for you to be faithfully present where you're called in the pickup line at school, like Lauren was talking about, or in your job as a nurse at the hospital with COVID patients overflowing, or with a teacher, whatever it is, what does it look like to be faithfully present for you so that the more of the light of the gospel would surround the place where you are?
I love that, because we could all do that. You look at the current issues, or the yelling at each other across different lines, or news, like that can just be so overwhelming. You think, oh, how are you going to do? But what you're describing is very personal. It's very local. It's very simple. And the gospel is actually exactly made for those kinds of actions.
And I think those of us who realize that we've been overwhelmed by grace, I hope would be leading. For me, that the most winsome people for me to be around are these people who are just deep sense of gratitude for the things in their life.
Mm.
And that should be us. That should be us as believers, is, can you believe this? Can you believe that God chose someone like me? I think that if we walk into every day, not just singing about amazing grace, but being overwhelmed by how amazing that grace is, I think the people around us would start to notice that and recognize it as really different.
That's amazing. So it reminds me of a story that you told, and I feel like everyone really just does need to read the book. It's really interesting. And I actually did listen to you reading it, and I think I was like 3/4 of the way through it, and we got in the car and it like came on, was playing, and my husband was like, oh, Bill Haslam's book. And I was like, oh no, you need to start at the beginning. You can't listen here. So I like wouldn't let him. I like turned it off. I was like, you got to read the whole thing. But there's this story that you tell about the woman who, I think you said it was like late at night in a parking lot or something, but she confronted you about how you had eliminated cursive from this was the story. I think about that and I'm like, how you handle that in that moment, if you don't mind to like just quickly, I don't want to butcher it, to quickly share that with people, and how you handle it in that moment. Like, it's so character defining because it was the end of a long day. You were tired, like probably not at your best moment, right?
No, right. I was actually, we were up in Upper East Tennessee, up in Bristol, and we had a long way to go back to Nashville late at night. And one of the things about being elected office, you talk about what kind of Christ forming in you is, people can get to share their hearts and opinion with you frequently, not unlike being a pastor. And I was walking to the car. Okay, good. We're headed back. It's been a long day. And this woman grabbed me and said, I know why you did that. And I said, I know why you took cursive writing out of the schools. I didn't take cursive writing out of schools. She goes, yes, you did it because you don't want our kids to be able to read the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence as it was originally written. Well, and tried to explain that we hadn't taken cursive writing out of schools, and et cetera, et cetera. And finally, for all I realized, I just wasn't going to convince her of it. And I did my best to do that politely as I could. But in the middle of those discussions, what I always try to remind myself then and now, if somebody's really disagreeing with me, is this person's created in the image of God. And as frustrated as I am, I have to see her at that moment as a fellow image bearer. And as C.S. Lewis, you know, talks about, if we saw them in the afterlife, we would be inclined to bow down and worship them because we would see them in their glory. And it's just if I'm in an argument with somebody or disagreement, if I remind myself throughout that they're creating the image of God, well, I have to treat them much, much differently. If that person really is an image bearer, I can't feel the same way about them as I want to.
Your voice in that, Bill, is, I think it's more powerful than you even realize, having the experience you've been through and what you walked through, and to keep calling us back to that. Because it's easy, I'm just going to be honest with you, in seasons like this as a leader, it's easy to give myself a pass or an excuse because it is frustrating. It is hard. And you have conversations, you're like, why am I having this conversation with you? And I find that very subtle forms of pride and an arrogant I'm right creeping in. And when you share that, it hope for all of us, it calls us back to that place of humility, that recognizing the imago Dei in every person and the grace that's ours to even be in a place where we're having that conversation.
Yeah. And interestingly, John Lewis, the congressman who died, who was a leader in the civil rights movement, and he was being interviewed a year or two before he passed away. And he was talking about the civil rights movement and what people missed. He said, what people miss now is how firmly the whole civil rights movement of Lewis and Dr. King and others was rooted in this idea of imago Dei, of the image of God, the people created in the image of God. And that was the driving truth behind the movement. And when you think of it in that term, you think about the difference the civil rights movement made, then we start to see, again, the power of the gospel. If we'll look at these things through the way God looks at them, maybe the world would start to look different.
Yeah.
Man, it's so good. I just think that story really stuck out to me because I thought, first of all, this is just wild. Like, this is wild. And it's just one example, I'm sure, of many of things that you encountered. But it also is, despite whenever that happened, I feel like that translates to what's going on now. Like, every time I open up Facebook, it's like somebody's got some wild thing that it's like, where did that even come from? And that idea is so bizarre. And how did you make the connection there? Like, I'm pro-cursive. Like, that's sometimes I get on Facebook and I'm like, yeah, come on. It applies to like everything we see right now. And the way you handle it, I'm like, oh yeah, I don't think that's not how I want to handle things sometimes. And that's not how I am. But it's such a good example for all of us. I think more than ever, we're encountering people in our individual worlds that we have these tensions with that maybe we haven't had before. And so it's just really, it stood out to me as so applicable to all of our lives right now with how we're interacting with people who we may have differences with on things that you didn't say it was crazy, but I read it and I was like, that's crazy. But we just are all dealing with that right now. So I thought that was such a great example.
When you use that with one of the guys who traveled with us all during the campaign, Do you remember the song, if you're a country music person, oh, God is great, beer is good, people are crazy. Yeah. And every time we would walk away from a situation like that, he would start whistling that song. And I would do all I could not to just start dying laughing.
That's hilarious. I love it.
Yeah. One of the things, too, I'm going to add another word in here and that I find in the book that I'd love to hear you speak into all of us, just out of the humility and the vulnerability and the confidence in the gospel, to have the courage to walk this out. Because at one point you share, I mean, that the cursive criticism is, okay, what'd I do that? But legitimate, a couple of decisions that you made, one that I happen to be personally close enough to follow, a decision where people on the right got really angry at you, and then a decision where people on the left get really angry at you, and there's all this going on. Could you help us think a little bit about, okay, the vulnerability and humility, but just the courage to stay in the place where God's called you, even when you may be getting a lot of criticism from people that at one point saw you as an ally, now they don't? Because that happens too. In the middle of COVID, you're like, I thought we were all the same together until we start talking about masks and vaccines. But the courage to just stay in the place where God's called you.
You know, I think it really starts with this whole clear sense of calling. If I think this is what God is, in this case, being in office is what God has really called me to, then I can't say, or I shouldn't say, the only way I can stay in office is if I do these things. And here, seeing people are yelling on both sides, but more people are yelling on this side. So the only way I'll stay in office is if I stay with these folks, the majority of people who are yelling, instead of trying to figure out really what is the right answer. And you remember the time, it's right after, it's in 1 Samuel, Saul has just become king. Like, I think he'd barely been caught king, and they're fighting the Philistines, and they're outnumbered, I don't know, 6,000 to 600 or some ratio like that. And Samuel basically has told him, wait till I come back to offer a sacrifice. And Saul panics and takes things into his own hands and goes and offers his sacrifice. And Samuel comes back and goes, what are you doing? And Saul's response is, hey, man, I had to figure out something, so I just took things into my own hands.
Yeah.
And that's what we do. We think, listen, God, I know you say to do this, but right now I got to make this work. And so through hustle, muscle, and sweat, I'm going to make this thing work. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, right? When we try to take things into our own hands, ultimately it just doesn't work.
It doesn't. I love that sense of going back to what is my calling, not what am I supposed to do to make everybody happy or fix things or get what I even get what I want.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I think, one last thing there, real quick. Yeah. Here's what I think we've lost in today's political discussion. We've so dug in the trenches on our side that we've forgotten that this stuff really does matter in terms of the government at its best is about solving problems and serving people. And it's not about winning the argument. Mm. And if you feel like I really am called to serve, then you're called to solve problems and serve people, not to win the argument. And that should help us all when we're trying to think about how do we remain faithful in a difficult situation.
That's such a good perspective. I want to ask you two things. Would love to hear your opinions on, and then we'll wrap this up. So just politics in general, there are some people who are listening who are like, I don't understand why I should be involved. And then there's some obviously listening who are really into politics. Mm-hmm. But what do you say to people about, like, why is this important? Why should we be invested in who our leaders are? And why take an interest in what's happening? Why is it important that I teach my 10, 8, and 6-year-old about politics?
Yeah, I think this God cares about what we call the common good. It says he sends his rain on the just and the unjust, the sun to shine on the righteous and unrighteous. It's not, God doesn't just care about what happens to his people, the church. He cares about the common good. And the verse out in Jeremiah before, the Israelites are in captivity in Babylon, and Jeremiah writes him and says, seek the peace of the place where I've called you. Plant gardens, build houses. For its welfare, you'll find your welfare. If we do think that God cares about the world, God so loved the world that he sent his own son, then we should care about how we are governed, because it makes, my observation from having been in office, it makes so much difference who we elect. And not just, and that's not by party, but by whether folks are focused on really serving. And so when people are doing the right thing, then those folks who need government, a lot of us are privileged enough, all we need is a driver's license, but a lot of folks need it for have mental health issues addressed, or they have a disabled child, or they can't afford health care without Medicaid, or whatever it would be, or they have a son in the correction system. Those folks need government to really work, and whether it's trying to work out issues around international peace or justice at home, it matters who we elect. So if believers just say, listen, all that's too messy, I'm out of here, it's all too gray and muddy for me, I'm out of here, then I think we're relinquishing one of the best ways that we can help to make this world look a little more like the world that is to come. But for the other folks who think, oh, my whole world is this, I would say God cares about what happens here, as I just said. But our future is not going to be determined by who wins the next election. And God's providence is so much bigger than those of us who think, oh, man, this next election is the most consequential of our time. If my candidate doesn't win, the world is doomed. I don't think that looks very faithful either.
That's so good. Okay, we don't have time to dive into this. This could be an entire podcast episode, but I thought it was fascinating how you talked about people saying, oh, I'm so glad, like when you were elected, that we have a Christian governor in the office mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I thought that was so fascinating because that's something that I've always heard. And growing up in church, you vote for the Christian leader and whatever. And you address that in your book. And it is just, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, and it is a way longer conversation. But I love it when people of faith raise their hand and run for office. And I love it when people in office are trying to serve our God. But I think the expectations that people have, they're going to make this a Christian country or a Christian state. Those aren't realistic and they're not healthy. God, one of the brilliant things our founders did was say, in our country, religion is going to be so important that government's not going to get to play a role at all. That we're not going to establish, we're not going to have a state-run church. We're also not going to let the government interfere with the free exercise of religion. And when I was first elected governor, I said, oh, great, now I bet you can make certain all of our public schools have prayer time and on down the line of expectations. And I was very cautious to say, we don't want the government interfering in religion and we don't want them establishing religion. That has never ended well for the church. If you look at where the church has historically struggled, places like Europe today, it's where the state used to run the church and it doesn't ever end well.
That's such a great perspective, Bill. Thank you for all of that. Such a gift to us.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Final thought, any final words on having a faithful presence in each of our lives, each of our public squares that we're serving in?
Yeah, I stole the title from an author named James Davidson Hunter with his full permission. But think about both of those words. First of all, what's it look like to be faithful where God's called me? What would it look like if I truly trusted God in what the places he's called me today? So that'd be first. And the second would be present. Too many of us are not where God has put our feet. And being present means engaging in those places that God has called us to and believing that this is where God has called me to for now, maybe forever, but for now. And so I want to be fully present here and I want to think through what it looks like for me to be fully faithful as well.
Thank you for the time you've spent with us today and for the wisdom that you're sharing with us and our listeners. And we are it's a grace to be with you. We're blessed to have you on here today.
You and Rick both make it easy and fun. So thanks for having me. It was a really fun time.
It was great, Bill. No, our listeners are going to love this. And we'll make sure there's a connection to the book in the show notes because we would highly recommend it.
Yeah, everybody check out the show notes and we'll put any extra information in there. So thank you so much. And we'll talk to you later. Everybody have a great day.
My privilege. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Life Reframed.
We so appreciate our Life Reframed listeners. Thank you for being a part of our conversations. We hope that you enjoy them and just learn as much as we do when we have the conversations because we literally are creating as we go. So thanks for being a part of that creative process. If you love this podcast, you can go rate us on Apple Podcasts with a 5-star rating. That always helps us. You can share this podcast with others who you think might enjoy these conversations or benefit from them. And above all, Have these conversations with the people around you. It's not about expertise. We've demonstrated that well. We're just learning together. And this is how it works for God to work in our lives by grace. We are so thankful for our tech team, our communications team. Their support, their creativity, and their excellence makes this podcast work. And finally, to Brandon, who happens to be my son, Zach, thanks for another great round of music for our intro and outro. We love it. And when I hear it, I think of you, Zach. So we appreciate you. We love you all. Thanks for listening. And we look forward to the next conversation on Life Reframed.